This show was previously broadcast live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
My guest this morning is Jim Fetzer. Jim is the Distinguished Department of Philosophy McKnight University Professor Emeritus at the University of Minnesota Duluth. He's also a prolific author of numerous articles and 20 books in the philosophy of science and on the theoretical foundations of computer science, artificial intelligence, and cognitive science. Well, those aren't the topics today. Jim is also the founder of Scholars for 9/11 Truth. It's a nonpartisan association of faculty, students, and scholars dedicated to exposing the official lies, removing the shroud of deceit, and revealing the disturbing facts about 9/11. Certainly not the official story that we've been told. Jim, I welcome you, and you suggested a few topics for today. We can get into those, and we can get into as much whatever else is on your mind. We've got a whole hour to do it. And, I mean, one that grabbed me, and I know this happened, but I haven't really looked into it very carefully. You mentioned that former Governor Jesse Ventura has been banned from the Huffington Post. And I guess it's over his views about 9/11. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you very much, Stephen. It's a real pleasure to be here. Yes, it's fairly astonishing that the governor would be invited to contribute an article about 9/11 Huffington Post, and then they would remove it with the explanation that they do not support conspiracy theories. Think of the absurdity of that, Stephen. The official account of 19 Islamic fundamentalists hijacking these four aircraft, outfoxing the most sophisticated air defense system in the world and perpetrating these atrocities under the control of a guy in a cave off in Afghanistan, is obviously a conspiracy theory. So apparently if we follow the Huffington Post line, we can't even talk about 9/11.
You know, Jim, the idea, let me use some other names. The idea, say, that people like you, me, and a few of our friends could get together for a few planning sessions in our kitchen, in our living room, in our garage, maybe in a hotel room, and come up with this scheme, as you say, to literally subvert the most sophisticated intelligence in the world. Of course, the U.S. has 16 intelligent agencies, not just the CIA, not just the NSA, 16 of them. My God, you think they'd stumble all over each other. But with all of these defenses, all these firewalls, you, me, and a few of our friends could go through them all like a knife through butter and bring down the Twin Towers and damage the Pentagon. Who knows what else we could do? Maybe we could take out the White House and the Capitol and the Supreme Court. I mean, the idea that anybody would believe a story like that, I can't imagine that a 10-year-old would believe it, let alone anybody a little bit more advanced than somebody that age. One more comment. I literally, shortly after 9/11, I literally heard a 10-year-old. I heard a 10-year-old explain it more lucidly than any adult believing in the preposterous official story. A 10-year-old.
Well, you know, Stephen, it's remarkable how these terrorists have to know that 9/11 was the very day that the United States Air Force was going to conduct anti-terrorist drills, as many as 17 different ones, a kind of patchwork quilt. If you read Webster Tarpley's discussion about it in his book, 9/11 Synthetic Terror Made in the USA, and where they left behind no indications they'd even been aboard those planes. Elias Davidson, a German scholar, has published a piece you can find on Google showing that the government has produced no evidence that those guys were aboard the planes, no ticket receipts, no passenger manifest. In fact, the manifests that were released by CNN on 9/11, I printed them out, Stephen, they not only show no name of any Islamic terrorist, they show no Arabic name at all.
It's amazing how the major media, Jim, conveniently never talks about this. What's really disturbing is when too many on the progressive side of the line absolutely will not touch this. I heard a short portion of a talk given in 2004 by John McMurtry, Monty Faulkner on KPFA's Guns and Butter program, a weekly program, ran the talk. John McMurtry, another professor emeritus, a Canadian, Guelph University. I had him on my program once. Oh, it was a wonderful talk. I mean, he says all the right things, the same as you do, Jim. And he mentioned that he had a debate with a well-known progressive. I don't want to embarrass the guy. I know him, too. I don't want to embarrass him, so I won't mention his name. He had a debate with him, and McMurtry was very much on the side, debunking the official line about 9/11. I mean, how preposterous the whole idea was. And this other guy wouldn't go near the topic, didn't even want to discuss it. A progressive?
Well, John's an exceptional scholar, Stephen. He contributed a very important chapter in my book on 9/11, which is entitled The 9/11 Conspiracy, in which he placed those events within the broader geopolitical context of world events. He's an admirable scholar. And what stuns me about the progressive figures on the left, Stephen, is they don't know anything about the case. They don't understand, for example, that the fires burned too low and too briefly to bring about the weakening of steel, much less its melt. They don't know that the fires were distributed asymmetrically, which meant if they had burned long enough and hot enough, there would have been an asymmetrical gradual collapse, very tilting of a floor, you know, sagging. There would have been the complete abrupt and total collapse of those twin towers, which took place in 10 seconds, according to the official 9/11 commission report, even, Stephen. Moreover, they don't even look at the gross photographic evidence of the collapse of those buildings. Recently, new 9/11 photographs were released. I have published them in my blog at jamesfetzer.blogspot.com, and VoltaireNet picked up on it and has published them, too, in an article on 18 February, revealing new aerial photos of 9/11 attack released. Stephen, the massive conversion of those two 500,000-ton buildings into billions of cubic yards of very fine dust cannot possibly have taken place on the basis of the kind of pancake collapse the government claims.
Oh, without question, Jim. What bothers me the most about the progressives who don't buy the story is they don't even want to look. They don't want to go looking for the evidence that's all over the place. You know, I mean, high school kids could easily research this and write a terrific article on it. You know, not as well as a scholar like you, Jim, but they could write a terrific article. They could list the facts. They'd be very clear. Anybody could understand them. And it would be a case that you could make in a court of law. And it would take a very corrupt judge to rule against you. I mean, the facts are there. So many, Jim. David Ray Griffin has done such wonderful work, just like you, and he's been on my program twice. And he keeps going back and back over this again. And I mean, one fact after another, Jim. It's amazing that the whole world doesn't really understand this. And And what's important, what's most important is this is the defining event of our time, because everything that's happened grievously to us, from foreign wars to police state laws to the greater shredding of civil and human rights, everything really stemmed from this one act. And we don't expose it publicly, and we don't reverse this. We don't reverse this story and really get at the criminals who caused this, who weren't the people we say they were.
Stephen, you mentioned David Ray Griffin. He's such an admirable fellow and the leading expert on 9/11 in the world today, published recently in Global Research two articles about the phone calls from the planes. And, Stephen, it's astonishing. It turns out that all of those phone calls were fake. None of those phone calls were genuine. I have an expert on the military who has suggested to me that the simulation of phone calls may have been prepared in advance as a part of a training up by the military so they could put all the pieces in place to use them when they went live on 9/11. But just consider, all of those phone calls are fake, and you can read about it in a wonderful article by David Ray Griffin on Global Research.
Oh, absolutely, Jim. I think I've seen other articles on this, too. Back then in 2001, we did not have the technology we have today, and at the altitude those planes were flying at, it was impossible to make a cell phone call. It just couldn't happen.
You're going to love this, Stephen. Pilots for 9/11 Truth have been doing a lot of good work on the planes involved, and they've discovered, you know, two especially important aspects of the case. One is that in relation to New York City, the footage we have of Flight 175 hitting the South Tower. Now, your listeners will remember that's the second hit, so, you know, there were opportunities to have cameras holding it. Was flying too fast to be aerodynamically possible for a 767, which is what that Flight 175 was supposed to be. It's flying around 540 miles an hour, which is the cruising speed of that plane at 35,000 feet, Stephen. But when you bring it down to 700 to 1,000 feet, it's an impossibility. The plane would destabilize. You couldn't fly it. Might even fall apart, according to Joe Keith, who designed the shaker system for Boeing. So something's wrong with the videos there. And as you may or may not have noticed, because it's subtle, you have to do freeze frames. The way the plane enters the building provides no more resistance than air itself. We've counted the number of frames it takes for the plane to pass through its own length in air, Stephen, and the number of frames it takes for that plane to pass through its own length into the building. And astonishingly, they are the same, which means that this 500,000-ton steel and building provided no more resistance to the flight of that aircraft than did air. Something is wrong. And, Stephen, at the Pentagon, they have studied the black box data provided to them by the National Transportation Safety Board, which it claims comes from Flight 77. And when pilots studied that, they discovered that the black box data they received from the government shows a completely different approach, virtually perpendicular toward the building instead of at an acute angle, that is 300 feet too high above the ground to hit any of those lampposts, that when it's 1 second from impact, it's 100 feet above the Pentagon, that this plane swerved off, did not hit the building. While a much smaller plane may have approached and hit the building, it was not the commercial area the government claims, and you can find the analysis of the black box data on the Pilots for 9/11 site under Pandora's Black Box. A second research group, by the way, called Citizens Investigative Team, or CIT, has now produced a new documentary called National Security Alert, in which they have discovered seven or eight witnesses who testify that the plane approached from north of the Citgo station instead of south. That's crucial, because if the government account were true, the plane would have had to approach from south of the Citgo station, but all of these witnesses attest that it approached from the north, which is consistent with the black box data the pilots have analyzed.
And all the rest, Jim, just at the Pentagon, the damage done to the building, where the Pentagon was hit, experienced commercial pilots might have almost found it impossible to guide a large aircraft that low through all the obstructions and hit the Pentagon at that spot, which coincidentally was the only part of the Pentagon that was undergoing renovation. So all the admirals and the generals, they weren't located there. And if my memory is right, in the aftermath, there were no bodies. There was no fuselage. There were no engines. And there was a very strange hole through the Pentagon that would have been impossible for an aircraft to make. I guess it had to be a cruise missile, Jim.
Well, actually, that hole inside looks, in the C-ring, Stephen, has spray painted on the wall, punch out. It looks to me it's perfectly symmetrical. It couldn't have been caused by any part of a plane coming at any angle. It looks as though it was deliberately blown to create confusing evidence using cordite, a common military explosive, where many on the scene reported smelling cordite. Moreover, your point about the hit point is impeccable. Many people think that the roof collapse area is where the plane hit, but that roof collapse only occurred about 20, 25 minutes after the original impact, which was on the ground floor. It's only about 10 feet high and 16 or 17 feet wide. We're talking about a 100,000-pound aircraft, which had a 125-foot wingspan, Stephen, a tail that stood 44 feet above the ground, and in fact flying barely above the ground level turns out not even to be aerodynamically possible at 500 miles an hour, which is attributed to it because of what is known as wind effect. It should have not been able to get closer than 60 feet to the ground. And precisely as you observed, there's no massive pile of aluminum debris. There's no seats, bodies, luggage. There's no wings. Not even the engines were discovered. The tail wasn't broken off. Jamie McIntyre, who was the first reporter on the scene for CNN, reported, and you can find this on YouTube, that there were, from his observation, there were no indications that any plane, any large plane, had hit the building. No large pieces of fuselage, no tail, no wings. And here's something else, Stephen, that's really quite astonishing to contemplate. Remember when those planes hit the steel and concrete twin towers, how they made those messy cutouts, those cookie cutter cutouts that some of us think may well have been faked? Well, down at the Pentagon, although it has a limestone facade, where limestone is a very soft stone, you don't see any impression of the plane there. I mean, those who are apologists who try to defend the official try to talk you into believing, but I tell you, it isn't there. It is no more there than the massive pile of aluminum, the wings, the engines, or the tail. None of them are there, just as Jamie McIntyre observed.
Oh, Jim, I lost you.
I'm here. I'm still here. And of course, you know, as we go further, it turns out that Colonel George Nelson, who is an Air Force expert, has observed that although there are millions of uniquely identifiable component parts from these four aircraft, the government has yet to produce a single one. And, Stephen, if you can believe this, when the FBI was asked why there had been no investigation of these plane crashes, which, of course, are mandated under law, they dismissed it and said it wasn't necessary because we saw it on television.
We saw it on television. My goodness gracious. That's the FBI. This is the way law enforcement conducts investigations. Jim, we all remember that day so well, and I remember certainly on that day we weren't quite sure exactly what was going on. But I may have mentioned this to you when we were on together before, but without my knowing just what really is this thing, I wrote a letter to my brother that evening, and I still remember the punchline of my letter, and it was, they're drinking champagne in the White House tonight. Whatever this thing was, I knew that whatever would happen in the aftermath would be all bad for us and all wonderful for them, exactly what they wanted, except we had no idea what they really had in mind, but it wouldn't take too long to find out. It wouldn't take long at all.
I participated in a Ron Paul Freedom Rally on the grass in front of the Capitol on the 15th of April, 2008, Stephen, and I presented a talk analyzing exactly this, which was subsequently published under the heading 9/11, the Neocon Agenda, in which I explained that the driving motives appear to have been oil, taking control of Iraqi oil, either to pump it out of the ground cheaply or to leave it in the ground and force up the price of everyone else's product. Israel, dismantling the most sophisticated Arab state, Iraq, which had a wonderful health care system, national education system, marvelous antiquities dating back thousands of years, a viable infrastructure, reliably producing water and electricity for Iraq, in part also because Saddam had been providing $25,000 bounties to the families of suicide bombers, which annoyed the Israelis. But they didn't like the idea of this very sophisticated state being so influential in the region. And finally, of course, the neocon itself, in the narrower sense of the project for the new American century, moving American military forces into the Middle East and projecting force outward from that geopolitically sensitive area. You can read about it, of course, on the project for the new American century under rebuilding a document entitled Rebuilding America's Defenses that was signed and supported by, a host of these so-called neocons, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Donald Fife, Richard Perle. Even General Richard Mayers has to be taken into account here, I believe, where all of them appear to have been involved in 9/11, along with Rudy Giuliani and Larry Silverstein, who took possession of the Twin Towers into his private hands 6 weeks before and immediately fired the security company that had been taking care of the World Trade Center ever since its first occupancy in 1970. There's a huge story here, Stephen. And as you well know, as a part of the Rebuilding American Defenses document, they were asserting there was a unique historical opportunity here, given the demise of the Soviet Union, for the United States, the sole remaining superpower, to take control of the world, to dominate the world for the next 100 years, which would be the new American century, but that the American people might not be willing to support the wars of aggression this would entail, moving into the Middle East to take control of its territory and to occupy that land, unless they observed in print there were some precipitating event that galvanized support for this, such as a new Pearl Harbor. And, of course, when David Ray Griffin began his research and published his first book on this, it was entitled The New Pearl Harbor, Stephen. That's what they gave us on 9/11.
Oh, I've got David's book on my shelf and his book about the 9/11 Commission, and absolutely right, Jim. And the only way you can get people to go along with such outrageous things that we've done is scare them to death, and to do what we really had in mind, knowing what it is now, we really had to come up with a massive event. You can't just come up with the terrorist of the week or the terrorist of the month. You know, that serves a very brief period. You need to come up with something really, really big. And then, of course, the media goes along and they hype the fear and they build it so that, well, my God, George Bush, his approval rating on September 10th was roughly about 50%. I don't know why it was that high, but he was just slogging along, kind of a nondescript president. No great support, no great opposition. And on September 11th, or maybe the day after, it shot up to 90%.
Isn't that amazing? Shot up to 90%. And he was in terrible, as you observe, in terrible political shape. But, of course, you know, ever since when they instituted that color code system, Stephen, when they needed political support, when they were in a difficult political position, it elevated the terror alert. And it appears to many of us that a number of these subsequent alleged attacks, like the shoe bomber or the underpants bomber, or those who were supposed to be mixing this batch of toxic brew in the lavatories, the airliners, were all staged. They're all hoaxes, really, all intended to instill fear into the American people to continue to manipulate us for political purposes.
Oh, absolutely, Jim. I've written on at least two dozen of the so-called terrorists that make headlines in this country, mostly Muslims. Every single one of them, absolutely innocent. I went through it, found material about them. I could find nothing that really said these people are really folks that we need to worry about. They were framed. The evidence was bogus. In a courtroom, it's theater. It's not a courtroom. It's theater. The prosecution uses secret evidence. Sometimes they have witnesses that don't reveal themselves. Everything that is kept under wraps is for "quote unquote" national security. How can you have a defense? And they're so clever. They're so good at what they do. I mean, they scare honest to goodness people. People yeah. who say to themselves, even when they believe the person being tried may not be guilty, they leave enough shadow of a doubt in their mind to make them feel, well, what if we're wrong and we let a real bad guy out on the street? Maybe we better not take a chance. So they almost always go along with the prosecution and convict. And there was one case that I didn't write an entire article about. I mentioned it specifically in one article. I think I mentioned it briefly in another one. Several young black kids. I don't know if any of them were Muslims or not. They were poor black kids. These were the ones down in Miami. They were accused of wanting to blow up the FBI building there and the Sears Tower in Chicago. God, Sears Tower in Chicago, blow it up. The FBI building, blow it up. Well, twice they went on trial, and they were exonerated. Either a hung jury, I forget what it was, but they were not convicted. So the Justice Department came back a third time. I think the third time was Obama's Justice Department, and they finally got them convicted. You know, double jeopardy. They can't go back with the same charges. They just reconstruct them, reconfigure them, and charge them with something different enough so they can get them back in the courtroom in front of a jury, and the prosecution tries not to make whatever they think were the mistakes of the first time, the second time. And they probably do it half a dozen times until they got these people convicted. So you're in their sights forever if they want to get you, including lawyers.
Stephen, it's outrageous. In fact, probably these gang members, when they were approached by this FBI undercover agent who was offering them money if they would do something like this, were just stringing him along so they could get the money, but never had any intention of doing anything as stupid as that, which was far beyond their capabilities. What stuns me today, Stephen, is that Barack Obama should tell us that the reason for sending 30,000 more troops into Afghanistan is because that is the location from which America was hit and where Osama bin Laden is known to reside. This is all quite absurd. We have ample evidence that Obama died around December 15th of 2001. David Ray Griffin has even published a new book about it entitled Osama bin Laden, Dead or Alive, that marshals the evidence. And for the President of the United States not to know more about the events of 9/11 when they're so easily accessible, to me, is a source of acute distress. I supported this man because I thought he was intelligent, capable, articulate, committed, and knowledgeable. And now it appears he's massively ignorant about the pivotal event of the 21st century, as W has been inclined to describe it.
Well, I don't know how ignorant he is, Jim. I mean, he certainly is following the party line, and I think of him as a neocon in disguise. He poses James Petras, who comes on my program a lot. James Petras wrote a great wrote a number of articles about Obama, but in one of them, I forget the exact title, but it was something like Obama is the first Jewish no. I'm thinking of another one. He also called him the first Jewish president because of his support for Israel against the Palestinians. But in one of his articles, he had a Melville quote about him being the greatest con man in modern times. He'll be your smooth buddy while he picks your pocket.
Well, you know, Stephen, with Rahm Emanuel as his chief of staff, who's probably the most powerful man in the world as opposed to the president, he can basically manage the flow of information of the president and thereby manipulate him. He's, of course, a joint U.S.-Israeli citizen, as were so many of those I mentioned before. In fact, even Michael Chertoff, get this, Stephen, you know, these five dance Israelis, the residents across the river observed five individuals on a rooftop who were filming the destruction of the World Trade Center, celebrating dressed in Arab garb. They reported them to the police. The officer approached the van to arrest them. The driver said, we are not your problem. The Palestinians are your problem. They were incarcerated for 71 days until they were released by an assistant to then Attorney General John Ashcroft. They returned to Israel. Three of them went on Israeli television and explained they were there to document the destruction of the World Trade Center. The person who released them, the assistant to then Attorney General Ashcroft, was none other than Michael Chertoff, who's also a joint U.S.-Israeli citizen and who would become a head of Homeland Security. By the way, the day before 9/11, Donald Rumsfeld announced to the public that the Pentagon has track of $2.3 trillion. That's with a T, $2.3 trillion, Stephen, on a Monday. And that's quite bizarre, because any experienced Washington politician knows that if you release a big story like that on a Monday, the reporters are going to dog you all week, and it's going to, as they say, grow legs. It's as though he realized that something would intervene in the meanwhile that will obliterate from consciousness all awareness of this announcement, and he would be able to walk back into the halls of Congress and ask for hundreds of billions more into spending, which is exactly what happened. The controller of the Pentagon at the time was a fellow named Dov Zakheim, who is also a joint U.S.-Israeli citizen.
Oh, I remember that. Trillions of missing dollars, whatever it was back then, Jim. We're talking about heaven only knows how many missing trillion dollars now. We know about lots that have been handed out. What we don't know about is what they won't tell us about. Jim, I want to give you a chance to catch your breath. Let's just take a short break. And if you want to get a sip of water or something, go grab it, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Thanks very much, Steve.
You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Progressive Radio Network is looking to expand its programming, and we are looking for your ideas. If there's a subject that you are passionate about and we don't cover it, let us know. Give us a call at 646-307-4482 or email our program director, Carolee@GaryNull.com. Carolee@GaryNull.com. The Progressive Radio Network, the number one forum for progressive minds.
Krishnamurti's dialogue is between him and us.
Krishna.
Krishnamurti's talks are about the art of living, which is greater than all things that human beings have created by mind or hand.
Krishna.
It's greater than all the scriptures and their gods.
Krishna.
It is only through the art of living that a new culture can come into being.
Krishna.
All existence is relationship. Without it, you cannot live.
Krishna.
There is only the actual and nothing else.
Krishna.
What is taking place now is free of time.
Krishna.
This is the evolution of our conditioning.
Krishna.
The art of living can come into being only when thought does not contaminate love.
Krishna.
Krishnamurti talks, Thursday nights at 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Become enlightened.
Krishna.
I'm Carol Brier, host of Community Currency on Progressive Radio Network every Thursday, 5 to 6 p.m. Please join us as we connect people, ideas, important information, and discover solutions to some of the most urgent problems facing us. Every Thursday, 5 to 6 p.m., Community Currency on Progressive Radio Network.
Thank you. Hi, this is Mike Fader. I'm doing a new show here on PRN every Thursday following Gary Null from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Time. It's called The Turning Point. What will we talk about? Well, everything, from birth to death and most things in between. I'll be using stories in the news and personal observations from my own life. And from time to time, I'll be taking your calls. So please join me, Mike Fader, every Thursday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Time for The Turning Point on PRN.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back. On with Jim Fetzer. We've been talking about 9/11. Is anyone listening to this program who doesn't understand exactly what we're talking about and are just as angry as we are that the official story is otherwise, and there are still even good people who should know better. They either know better or they should know better, or maybe they do and maybe they just don't want to ruffle feathers. Shouldn't we all go along with this? Shouldn't we all be very vocal, demanding that we simply won't tolerate the cover-up anymore? Anyway, one major story. Jim, you mentioned another article that you wanted to discuss, an article by Jerry Mazur on the magic bullet theory in a coup d'etat in America. Can I make one more comment about 9/11? I think it really is striking that a former governor of one of our states, Jesse Ventura, former governor of Minnesota, would write an article. I honestly didn't read the article, but I think he is on the side of people like you and me who simply don't buy the official rubbish.
Yes. You're absolutely right, Stephen, and he's appeared. He's making a lot of appearances in relation to a new book of his called American Conspiracies, co-authored with Dick Russell. And he's been appearing this past week, he appeared on the Today Show, on The View, on Larry King, and yet he gets the boot at Huffington Post. This is really quite outrageous. I'm afraid he may be getting a little too close to the truth, Stephen. He's causing people to become interested in 9/11 again, which is not what those who have benefited from 9/11 want. And the point made earlier is exactly right. I mean, the anti-war movement has to understand that unless you can defuse the alleged justification for 9/11, you heard it from Osama, from Barack Obama himself, that we are there in Afghanistan and he's sending in 30,000 more troops because of Osama bin Laden and 9/11. Until you understand that's a lot of hokum, that we're being lied to, that this is an enormous hoax, where the subtitle of my book, my collection of studies, is Scamming of America. And you can learn so much more at 9/11scholars.org. If you go there, in the upper left-hand corner, there's a piece entitled Why Doubt 9/11 that gives 15 or 20 refutations of the official account, Stephen. And in the upper right-hand corner, you get a link to patriotquestion911.com, where you'll find over 1,700 experts across the disciplines, military, intelligence, former government, all the academic disciplines, engineers, pilots, experts in every aspect of this case who are outraged by what the government has told us. You'll find their photographs, their bio statements, and why they are incensed and demand that this be straightened out. So Jesse goes on and writes a little piece that's going to stimulate some interest in the Huffington Post, takes it off steam. As you say, the progressive left appears to loaded with cowardice. It's just filled, infused with cowardice about 9/11.
Yeah, it really is, Jim. It's shocking and disturbing. And there aren't enough of us. We need all the allies we can get. And of people who should be on our side straight down the line. And what's most important to me, Jim, is on our side means most of all to me on the toughest issues. These are the ones that you have to be on the right side of. All the issues are important, but some are more important than other issues. And again, the dominant issue of our time is the 9/11 event. And if you're on the wrong side of that one, then I'm sorry. You're on the wrong side of everything that you claim to stand for. You've got to come down on this one. You've got to come down on it unrestrained, and you've got to demand the truth. You've got to talk about it. You've got to discuss the facts as we know them. And there's no backing off on this. And then you go from there. By the way, no less a figure than Zbigniew Brzezinski, one of the founders of the Trilateral Commission, a Rockefellerite from back in the 1970s, Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, close advisor to Barack Obama. In the 1990s, he wrote a book called The Grand Chessboard. He'll tell you why we're in Iraq and Afghanistan, not in so many words, but he calls Eurasia, which includes the Middle East, the grand prize. The grand prize. This part of the world has three-fourths of the world's energy. It's got three-fourths of the mineral and human wealth overall. I think another three-fourths of the world's population. It's the most important part of the world. Well, included is the Middle East, of course, Iraq. The one main country, one of the two main countries we don't control, and Afghanistan. Maybe Afghanistan has hidden oil, Jim. I don't know about it. It may. We've discovered that Haiti has oil.
Is the pipeline across northern Afghanistan that's at stake, apparently, Stephen, where we have several permanent bases located strategically to defend it? You may remember we had negotiations with the Taliban that if they allowed us to build this pipeline, we would bury them in gold, and if they did not, we would bury them in bombs. They didn't, and we did.
Oh, absolutely. I remember that. I absolutely remember that. I think that was the same warning given to Pakistan, the last guy who ran the country when we commissioned him to support us back in 2001. I think the deal was we'll either give you $10 billion or we'll blow you off the face of the earth.
Quite a choice. And you'll remember, too, when we confronted the Taliban and asked them to turn over Osama bin Laden, they said they would be glad to do that if we could produce proof that Osama bin Laden was involved. Well, even Colin Powell, Secretary of State at the time, yes, said he would do that. But, of course, we never did. And, in fact, it turns out that not only did Saddam Hussein have nothing to do with 9/11, not only was Iraq not in cahoots with al-Qaeda in relation to 9/11, but our own FBI has acknowledged, our own FBI, Stephen, that it has no hard evidence that ties Osama bin Laden to the events of 9/11. Now, how bad is that?
Oh, it's pretty bad. And, of course, even though I had David Ray Griffin on my program some months back on his book about Osama and the fact that it's virtually slam dunk sure that he died back in 2001. And yet, amazingly, his videos and audios keep popping up. I wrote one article about it, a very short one, and a couple of the progressive sites would not touch it. It was obvious that the video was what I really talked about. It was obvious that it was a fake. It simply wasn't Osama. And experts can figure this stuff out. They can see the real person. They can see the concoction that some movie maker, a video maker puts together, and they can come up with very clear evidence that this is not the real guy. This is something else.
Stephen, you're so right. And you mentioned these articles by Jerry Mazza, who, of course, is an independent New York journalist, writes for an online journal. This ongoing fakery is astonishing. It turns out that there's a computer scientist at Dartmouth who is funded by the FBI in his research and who has recently announced, and this did make the Huffington Post, that from his study of one of the backyard photographs, there are actually four of them, of the nose shadow, that he vindicated the photograph and said he thought it was authentic, ignoring the massive evidence that has proven over decades that the photos are faked. The figure in the image has a blocked chin, not Oswald's pointed chin. There's an insert line between the chin and the lower lip. The fingertips of his right hand are cut off. The height is wrong. Jack White, a legendary photo analyst, used the newspapers he's holding as an internal ruler to determine the height of the individual, and the person's only 5'6", whereas Lee Oswald was 5'10", which means that either the person they used as a stand-in was too short to be Lee Oswald, or what is more likely, when they introduced the newspapers, they put them in too long. Lee Oswald shown one of these photographs said that his face pasted on someone else's body and that eventually he'd be able to prove it. The fact of the matter is, just to show how shoddy is this Hanny Farrad's research, Stephen, the face and the shadows on the face and the expression on the face are identical in four different poses taken at four different times, which is a photographic impossibility. So here's a guy at Dartmouth University who is perpetrating the falsehood that Lee Oswald was the lone assassin of JFK and doing it with the imprimatur of Dartmouth College. This is so embarrassing. I have written repeatedly to Dartmouth about it, but they seem to be unwilling to lift at least digit to correct his effect on our nation's understanding of its own history. And would you believe the article on Lee Oswald in Wikipedia has now picked up on this piece by Hanny Farrad to claim that it substantiates the official account. What Jerry Mazza has also done, Stephen, and I appreciate your mentioning it, is publish a new book entitled The Magic of Bullet Theory and a Coup d'Etat in America, which I'm very pleased to say is a report of a study I did, a presentation I gave at Cambridge University, which was subsequently published in a peer-reviewed international journal that demonstrates that the claim made by the head of the House Select Committee reinvestigation, who's now a professor of law at Notre Dame, namely that if the magic bullet theory is false, that had to have been at least six shots from three directions, is completely correct, but we have proven, and you can find in that article, which is entitled Reasoning About Assassinations, you can Google it and download it yourself, not only is the magic bullet theory false, but JFK, there were at least six shots, and they were fired from at least three different directions. So I thank Jerry Mazza for bringing this to the attention of the American people, because the mainstream media, as a rule, will not touch it.
Oh, indeed so. Indeed so. Another date I remember very well, Jim. That date back in 1963, how well I remember that. Again, we didn't know what was happening. We have a better idea now, especially why was this man taken out by the state? The idea that a lone gunman or maybe a whole gang of gunmen, private gunmen, just decided they didn't like Jack Kennedy and wanted to get rid of him. I mean, the idea is just preposterous. If they want to protect the president, they can protect him, and if they want to kill him, there is nothing in the world that will keep him safe. There were a lot of reasons why the powers that be wanted to get rid of Kennedy. To me, if there's one that stands out above the others, Jim, and you've studied this, I have not, but the one that jumps out at me is that he wanted to get us out of Vietnam. And that was exactly the opposite of what the power folks wanted. They wanted escalation. And didn't he order 1,000 troops to be brought home?
Oh, yes. He was bringing our advisors. All of them would have been out by the end of 64. He wanted to wait to complete it until after the next election. But, Stephen, you know, the point you're making is incredible. A wonderful book by James Douglas, D-O-U-G-L-A-S-S, entitled JFK and the Unspeakable, traces John Kennedy's evolution from a more or less conventional cold warrior to a statesman for peace. He had not only gone ahead and signed the above ground test ban treaty with the Soviet Union against the opposition, the unanimous opposition of the Joint Chiefs. He was conducting covert initiatives to normalize relationships with Cuba, and he was having a private correspondence with Nikita Khrushchev because he was trying to arrange for the possibility for them to have dialogue that wouldn't be subverted by their own subordinates, where Khrushchev was surrounded by a lot of military hawks just as much as was JFK.
Oh, indeed, so.
And I believe I believe taking out JFK paved the way for 9/11, because if you can assassinate an American president in broad daylight in a major American city and then steal the body, alter the evidence, fabricate the x-rays, even substitute another person's brain, and create a new version of the whole movie to try to justify the whole phony account, well, who knows what you can be emboldened to do if you want to initiate a new world order based upon the occurrence of a new Pearl Harbor. Stephen, it's outrageous. There appear to be clear linkages where the JFK success of JFK inspired and emboldened those who brought us 9/11.
And another thing that Kennedy was very, very much against, I think in the same book, the Douglas book that you mentioned, Jim, that he wanted to get rid of the CIA if he could. I saw the quote, something like, if he had the power, he wanted to shred the CIA into 1,000 pieces and just scatter it to the winds. And my God, that was in the early 1960s. CIA had only been around since 1947. And he saw it as some kind of an evil institution he wanted to get rid of. Well, they had the way to get rid of him, and he didn't have the way to get rid of them.
That's right, Stephen. You're exactly right. He also wanted to cut the oil depletion allowance the Texas oilmen regarded as their akin to their divine right. He wanted to reform or abolish the Fed. I remember as a young Marine Corps officer holding one of these United States notes with a red embossed imprint instead of a Federal Reserve note with a green embossed imprint. He'd already directed the Department of Treasury to publish millions of dollars, print millions of dollars of United States notes in the belief that we really shouldn't be beholden to a private consortium of banks for printing the money of the United States, for which we then had to pay them interest. And, of course, he was cracking down on organized crime. Bobby had brought more indictments and convictions than ever in his history. J. Edgar had denied the existence of organized crime. Bobby shattered that with the Joe Valachi hearings, convinced everyone about the intricate structure of the mafia. And, of course, Lyndon wanted to become president of all the people. He was in terrible political shape at that point in time. He was swirling in scandals, including the Bobby Baker scandal. You'll remember, Stephen, Bobby Baker was Lyndon's chief assistant when he was majority leader in the Senate. He'd been Lyndon's bag man. There was going to be a vote in the Senate the afternoon of 22 November 1963 that was widely regarded as going to tarnish Lyndon so much that JFK could not run with him again. Richard Nixon was quoted that morning in the morning news saying he thought that JFK would not run with Lyndon again. Jack had already told his secretary, Evelyn Lincoln, he wasn't going to run with LBJ again. Lyndon was seeing this opportunity to become president of all the people slip right through his fingers. And he, together with J. Edgar, who despised the Kennedys, appear to have been principals in arranging for the assassination of his predecessor.
Oh, I think that is very possible. I think Russ Baker wrote a book on the Bush family, and in the book, he came on my program a couple of times, in the book, massive book, about the Bushes. If I have all the characters right, on the fateful day, Jim, November 22nd, 1963, coincidentally, there were three presidents to be in Dallas on that day. Lyndon Johnson, Bush Sr., and Richard Nixon. Now, Nixon, Baker believes, had absolutely nothing to do with the event. He was representing Pepsi-Cola at a convention, so he was getting paid to make a speech at a Pepsi convention. But Bush Sr., who very well may have been, maybe he was as much involved as anybody, and Lyndon Johnson were there. Incredible. These people there on that very day.
Let me tell you a little bit about Nixon. I had over 100 conversations with Madeline Duncan Brown, who was a mistress of Lyndon Johnson. She bore him a son in 1950. Their affair began in 1948. And it was not his only child out of wedlock, but it was his only male offspring. And Madeline told me about a social event at the home of Clint Murchison, one of the great oil barons, the night before the assassination. Only about 24 people were there, but it was quite a striking list. H.L. Hunt, who described himself as the richest man in the world, was there. John J. McCloy, our former High Commissioner to Germany and former Chief Executive Officer at Chase Manhattan Bank, was there. J. Edgar Hoover, of course, the Director of the FBI, was there. Madeline had thought maybe the event was in his honor, since he often stopped in Dallas on his way to California with his close personal friend Clyde Tolson, where they go to the Del Mar racetrack. And invariably, when Hoover would lay down his bets, his horse would win. Del Mar, it turns out, owned by Clint Murchison. George Brown of Brown and Root Heavy Construction, when the Vietnam War became a big-time enterprise, he received Brown and Root received $1 billion to dredge a new bay at Cam Ranh, even though Vietnam has many magnificent ports. Late in the evening, Lyndon showed up unexpectedly. These heavy hitters disappeared into a boardroom, and for about 15 minutes, after which Lyndon strode over to her, she expected him to whisper sweet nothings. Instead, in a hateful tone of voice, he told her after tomorrow he wouldn't have to put up with embarrassment from those Kennedy boys any longer. 6 weeks afterwards, on New Year's Eve, they had a rendezvous in the Driscoll Hotel in Austin, Texas, where Madden confronted Lyndon with rumors rampant in Dallas at the time that he'd been involved, since no one stood to gain more personally. Lyndon blew up at her and told her the oil boys and the CIA had decided that Jack had to be taken out. This story and Lyndon's involvement has been corroborated by Billy Saul Estes in his book, A Texas Legend, where he became convinced that Cliff Carter, Lyndon's chief executive assistant, and Malcolm Mack Wallace, who is an assassin for Lyndon who killed as many as 12 people at Lyndon's bequest, had been deeply involved. And in fact, he gave an interview to William Raymond, a French investigative reporter, in which he explained that Lyndon had sent Cliff Carter down to Dallas to make sure all the pieces were in place for the assassination.
That really is stunning. You've got a lot of information that I don't have. But what it amounts to, Jim, is that some of the most important events of our time have been completely suppressed. The real facts have just not come out, except for wonderful research by people like you and David Ray Griffin, others who've dug into this and come up with this material. But the only way people can find out about it is to read the material that you put together, to listen to programs like this with people like you on explaining it, and to get at these most important facts. And we need to know this stuff because the history that takes place, the events that take place in this country, result from events like this. It gives government a chance to do the kind of things they probably couldn't do unless these events happened. And we're never told. We're always told concocted reasons. The real important things we're never given any information about, and they change our lives, and they harm us. And the only way we can defend ourselves is to find out about this and do something about it.
And, Stephen, there's a great deal more about JFK, about 9/11, about other false flag attacks, about the takedown of Senator Paul Wellstone at my new blog, jamesfetzer.blogspot.com. And I want to compliment you for all of your efforts to bring the truth to the world about these controversial issues, including, of course, Stephen, one of your current passions, which I share, which is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, one of the transcendent, perhaps the transcendent human rights issue of our time.
It really is, Jim. I'm writing now about the peace process that they may try to crank up again, and I put a lot of stuff out on that. So many topics, so much to do, Jim, so few of us, but we just got to get behind this stuff because you and I both see the same thing. America is heading very close to the precipice, and the other end of it is not a place that any of us want to be. I literally see the darkest of despotism ahead unless we can figure out a way to stop this. Jim, we're out of time. We're out of time. I got to bring it to a halt. The next program is coming on. As always, a wonderful program, Jim. I hope you'll be back and we can do this again.
It's my honor, Stephen. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Jim. And join us again tomorrow. Another hour, same time, Thursday, Saturday, and Sunday. Make it a regular habit.
This show was previously broadcast live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.